You know, during the last 10,000 years, climate has been seesawing between North and South Atlantic Oceans, as revealed by findings presented by scientists at Lund University in Sweden. Cold periods they see in the North have corresponded to warmth in the South and vice versa. What these implies that Europe may face a slightly cooler future, they say, than predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How strange is all this? Well, my radio colleague Glenn Beck, who is also on CNN Headline News, is holding a program tomorrow night on CNN called Don't Miss. It's called Exposed, a Climate of Fear. It's a one-hour special report. It'll be Wednesday, 7 to 9 p.m., 7 and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I had an opportunity to talk with Glenn about this program. Glenn, so why did you finally decide to do a program on global warming and who's responsible for it?
You know, I tell you, George, it's you know, you and I have talked before. I am so concerned about our country. I'm so concerned about the direction we're going in. I'm concerned that we are dividing ourselves, that we're that the truth doesn't even matter anymore. You know, we did this with the exposing of the extremist agenda over in the Middle East, and the next on our list was the global warming lies that are happening. And honestly, George, what's most disturbing is the fact that we are living in a culture now that is increasingly telling people you are either a racist, a hate monger, a Nazi, whatever, if you disagree with them. And it's on so many subjects. And on this particular subject, it stuns me because we're talking about science. When have we ever stifled people when they talk and speak out against science or challenge science? That's what the problem was in the Dark Ages. And now we have politicians, not priests, but politicians and special interest groups saying, shut up. You're not allowed to question this.
And, you know, my views on global warming, even though I believe mankind might be speeding things up a bit,
I
think it's an Earth cycle. It's happened hundreds of thousands of years ago, and it's going to continue. And, you know, when you look at Mars, which its ice caps are melting, the sun, I think, has a tremendous reason for all of this.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're addressing this.
Yeah, you know, it's when you look at the facts, and I'm so disturbed by so many people that say, you know, I've got kids in school, and they're watching the Al Gore film in art class. They're watching it in English. They're watching it in mathematics. It is indoctrination, and it is really Nazi propaganda. It is the same kind of stuff that they did with eugenics back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. The same style. And you need to hear the other side. So the special really is not the global warming answer. It is all of the scientists that say, you know, that everybody says they don't exist. The scientists that are speaking out, the ones that are brave enough, we had several of them, they would not come on because they said, I will be ostracized from here on out. We have one scientist on. One of the guys was one of the lead authors of the IPCC Global Warming Report for the UN. Disagrees with the conclusions, and one of the authors came out and said, I many times lay awake at night and think, what have I done? What have I done to my career? What have I done to my family? Why have I put myself in danger? Why have I wrecked my career just to speak out about something that I believe in? It's really quite amazing and sad.
Glenn Beck's Exposed, a Climate of Fear. It'll be on Wednesday, 7 and 9 p.m. Eastern Time on CNN's Headline News. St. John Hunt is the eldest son of super spy E. Howard Hunt, 27-year career CIA covert agent and foreign station chief, most well known as the leader and director of the White House Plumbers Black Bag Team, who botched the burglary and arrest led to the impeachment and then eventual resignation of then-President Richard Nixon. E. Howard Hunt passed away at the age of 88 recently, was also involved in many of the CIA's most nefarious operations in Cuba and throughout Central and South America, including, but not limited, to the assassination of Che Guevara, the assassination of Allende, the coup in Chile, the coup in Guatemala, the orchestration of the Bay of Pigs, and plots to assassinate Fidel Castro. He is considered by some investigators to be one of the three tramps intercepted, detained, and photographed and released without arrest or charges near the grassy knoll at the Dealey Plaza scene of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. Even more significant, Hunt had direct knowledge of the planning, particulars, participants, and motives in the JFK assassination, and has confided and entrusted this information to St. John Hunt. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. St. John, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine, George.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Let's talk a little bit, first of all, about your father. You know, he went to jail 33 months in the Watergate situation. Were you aware at all of the many things that he was doing while you were growing up?
Well, I didn't find out that my father was in the Central Intelligence Agency until I was about 16 years old, and I guess that was just what my parents felt was an appropriate age time to let me know the true employer of my father. Up until that time, his cover had been as a embassy official traveling with the State Department. So during so when I was 16, my parents sat me down and told me that Papa worked for the CIA, and it wasn't too long after that 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 he changed his at least overtly changed his job to work for a company called Mullen and Company, and then later on he started working for the White House. But as it turns out, Mullen and Company was just a front for the CIA, and my father also confided into me to me later on in the last few years of his life that while he was involved with the Watergate capers and all the things he was doing for the Plumbers Unit at the behest of President Nixon, he was actually still reporting back to his superiors at Langley.
Did he ever tell you, St. John, why they broke into these offices, what they really wanted? What were they after?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about that, and the story has changed many times over the years. But one of the things my father told me was that they had reason to believe, and I don't know if this is in fact why they broke in. But one of the things was that they Nixon had reason to believe that the Democratic Party at the time was getting funds filtered through various banks and whatnot from Castro, from, you know, his communist regime, hoping to get a Democratic president elected, probably McGovern, at which time, if McGovern were to have been president, or Muskie perhaps, then they would have relaxed the trade embargo on Cuba.
So he wakes you up in the wee hours and says, I need some help here. I mean,
yes.
What were you thinking?
Well, I was absolutely stunned. I had been sleeping for several hours, and it was, you know, I don't know exactly what time it was, but it was very late. My room was in the basement of our compound called Witches Island in Potomac, Maryland, and my father just burst in this high state of anxiety, sweating profusely, clothes all disheveled, you know, tie, collar undone, and he just said he just flicked on my light, and I just sat, you know, bolt upright in bed, like, what the hell is going on here? And he goes, I, you know, don't ask me any questions. I need you to come upstairs right now, and I need your help. I was the only one in the house that night, except for our live-in housekeeper, who was in another part of the house.
Let's turn the clock back a little bit, St. John, if we can. Your father was furious with John F. Kennedy for not providing the air support in the Bay of Pigs, and he, along with a number of others, were very upset with him, weren't they?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely a fact. We grew up in our family hating Kennedy without really knowing why. You tend to, as a child, you tend to grow up, you know, taking your parents' points of view until you're able to process the information on your own later.
When we come back in just a few moments, I'm going to play this audio tape that you've provided us of your father. And how did it come into your possession?
Well, I had visited my father in 2003, in the summer of 2003, at which time he gave me certain handwritten memos and certain information disclosing his prior knowledge of the JFK assassination. When I flew back to my home in Eureka, California, in January of 2004, I just went to the mailbox one day, and in the mailbox was an overnight, postal packet. And, I didn't know what to expect. I could tell it was from my father's Miami address. And lo and behold, I opened the packet, and there was a single cassette tape in that, unmarked, unlabeled, and I popped it into my cassette deck at home, and bam, he just laid it out.
Why did he wait so long to say anything about the JFK assassination?
Well, he told me that, of course, he was very concerned about the legal ramifications about, admitting that he had prior knowledge of a plot to assassinate President Kennedy. He had testified twice before various Senate subcommittee and congressional hearings involved post Watergate, and he testified that he had no knowledge of a plot, no involvement in the plot, and so he certainly would have been guilty of perjury if not deeper legal problems resulting from the withholding of evidence or knowledge of a presidential assassination. There's no statute of limitations on that kind of thing. So he originally gave me this information when it was believed by all family members, by himself, by his doctors, that he had no more than a few months to live.
All right, stay with us, St. John. We'll be back in a moment. They say that dead men don't talk, but they do when they leave a tape behind. And also, of course, E. Howard Hunt was a super spy. He was very cagey. With what you're going to hear, was he just saying this as disinformation, or is this the fact? And we'll be back in a moment with our guest, St. John Hunt. His website, Saint, and you got to spell that out, S-A-I-N-T, stjohnhunt.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. St. John, while Richard Nixon was still president, of course, before his resignation, he was, I think, very concerned about your father. His name came up on those White House tapes. I think Richard Nixon was afraid your father knew too much.
Well, I think that's been established in the Nixon transcripts. Of all the people that Nixon feared, and it's interesting to think about this, is that he feared my father the most. Now, there's probably a lot of reasons for that, one of which would definitely be that Nixon and my father went back as far as the Eisenhower administration, where Nixon headed an off-the-shelf covert operation as vice president called Operation 40. Sometimes known as Group 40. And this was a clandestine, covert, black bag, wet operations team that trained Cuban exiles, that trained various people as hitmen for carrying out executive action. That's one of the things. So they had a long history together, and when Nixon was told by Haldeman that E. Howard Hunt was a part of the plumbers unit that had been hired by Charles Colson to do Nixon's dirty works, he just hit the ceiling. He knew that name very well. He said, open up that scab, and there's a hell of a lot of stuff in there.
That incredible picture of the three tramps of Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963, the names of Frank Sturgis, Daniel Carswell, your father, keep coming up, others as well. But I've got to tell you, the tramp, the third tramp, does have some kind of uncanny resemblance to your father.
Well, it's truly amazing. My father was a very unique-looking individual. I mean, of course, I can sense his features, some degree of surety. And when I saw that comparison photo, and I did see it the very first time it came out, I saw it posted on a telephone pole. It said, CIA killed JFK. It was a It was a lecture slideshow that was being held at a local university. Where when they showed that comparison photo, I almost fainted, because that individual, the short tramp with the hat on, looks, to me, my gut feeling as his child, that looks exactly like my father.
And the fellow in front of him looks just like Frank Sturgis, who also was implicated in Watergate. And I do believe your father mentioned his involvement in JFK's assassination as well, did he not?
Well, yes, he did. As a matter of fact, that does look a lot like Frank Sturgis. I would say the only difference would be the hair. Frank, being a Cuban, had curlier hair, but that can be certainly altered for the sake of appearance. My father testified before the various Senate committees that he had never met Frank Sturgis until 1971, when he was introduced to Frank by Bernard Barker. But in the memos and in conversations I had with my father, he revealed to me that, in fact, he had known Frank for a long time, that they had worked together during the Bay of Pigs operation.
What's so incredible, too, about this picture, St. John, is other than the person purported to be your father, who truly looks like a tramp, he had dirty clothes and a ruffled shirt and everything else, the two people in front of him have clean shoes, clean pants. I mean, they look... They look just like preppies.
Yeah. In fact, they do look like they're well-washed.
Now, your father, of course, sends you this tape. We're going to play this in just a moment. And I've got to ask you this. Do you, first of all, believe his story? I mean, he's named LBJ. He's named a fellow by the name of Cordmeyer, who was with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
What if your father was just lying to protect himself, to protect all of you, and to protect those who truly might have been involved in the JFK assassination?
Well, a couple of points here. I don't think he would have lied, because at that point there was no pressure from any other angle that would have caused him to create a story. Second of all, if he were interested in creating or fabricating a story about the JFK assassination, he certainly would not have implicated some of his closest associates in the Cuban exile community and in the CIA, and certainly would have not implicated by inference the American government itself. He would have much more than likely fabricated a story involving a Soviet plot, painting a picture that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Soviet sympathizer, that was a Soviet agent, or something along those lines. He was still an agency man, my father was, and although he had been he'd been bitter about his treatment by the American government, the Nixon White House, he was still at heart a patriot, and would not had said anything to sully the reputation of the CIA or the American government.
Do you believe your father could have been, if he's one of these tramps in this picture, could have been involved in the assassination?
Well, the photograph of the tramp certainly looks very, very much like my father. By my father's own testimony to me, by his own admittance to me, he was a bench warmer, those are his words, in the big event, which was the running code name for the assassination to kill President Kennedy.
Sure. So he knew it was coming down. Right.
Well, according to what he told me, he knew that it was coming down. He had attended a couple of meetings at safe houses in Miami, Florida, and apparently the plot was to have taken place in Miami.
All right. Now, we're going to listen to a tape. You're going to hear some names mentioned. This is the voice of E. Howard Hunt in a tape that he sent to his son, St. John Hunt. It's a longer version of the tape. What you're hearing is an edited, shorter version.
I heard from Frank that LBJ had designated Cordmeyer Jr. to undertake a larger organization while keeping it totally secret. Cordmeyer himself was a rather favored member of the Eastern aristocracy. He was a graduate of Yale University. and had joined the Marine Corps during the war and lost an eye in the Pacific fighting. I think that LBJ settled on Meyer as an opportunist, Perrin like himself, a Perrin, and a man who had very little left to him in life ever since JFK had taken Cord's wife as one of his mistresses. I would suggest that Cord Meyer welcomed the approach from LBJ, who was, after all, only the vice president at that time. And, of course, could not number Cord Meyer among JFK's admirers. Quite the contrary. As for Dave Phillips, I knew him pretty well at one time. He worked for me during the Guatemala project. He had made himself useful to the agency in Santiago, Chile, where he was an American businessman. In any case, his actions, whatever they were, came to the attention of the Santiago station chief. And when his resume became known to people in the Western Hemisphere Division, he was brought in to work on Guatemalan operations. Sturges and Morales and people of that ilk stayed in apartment houses during preparations for the big event. Their addresses were very subject to change, so that where a fellow like Morales had been one day, you're not necessarily associated with that same address the following day. In short, it was a very mobile experience. Let me point out at this point that if I had wanted to fictionalize what went on in Miami and elsewhere during the run-up for the big event, I would have done so. But I don't want any unreality to tinge this particular story, or the information, I should say. I was a bench warmer on it, and I had a reputation for honesty. I think it's essential to refocus on what this information that I've been providing you, and you alone, by the way, consists of. What is important in the story is that we've backtracked the chain of command up through Cordmire and laying the doings at the doorstep of LBJ. He, in my opinion, had an almost maniacal urge to become president. He regarded JFK as he was, in fact, an obstacle to achieving that. He could have waited for JFK to finish out his term and then undoubtedly a second term. So that would have put LBJ at the head of a long list of people who were waiting for some change in the executive branch.
You know, I've already passed this story on to Glenn Beck at CNN, Headline News, St. John, and I think this story will probably become world news in a much bigger way than it already has very shortly. An amazing story, absolutely, which may either open up the door or at least close the door to, I think, one of America's darkest hours.
Yeah, it is truly amazing, and from my point of view, as my father's son, I have the deepest love and the fondest memories of my father, the greatest respect for him, and I think that at the end of his life he was certainly brave enough to pass this information on to me. He we had quite a few conversations about this, And it was at his behest that I wait until he passed away that I should reveal this. And I want to thank your station Coast to Coast and you, sir, for allowing me the time to disseminate this information.
Well, you know, I was 13 when JFK was killed. It's a story that we have all chased for years. If this confession of your father is accurate, it vindicates, I think, generations of people, historians, researchers, whistleblowers, some who have given their lives to expose the truth about Dealey Plaza at a point where everybody laughed. I mean, the Mark Lanes, the late Jim Garrisons,
yeah,
the Jim Mars, and people like that, with a list, of course, way too many to mention.
Yeah. All those people you mentioned and many, many more assassination researchers have been targeted by the right-wing media for far too long as being kooks and conspiracy theorists and, blackballed from mainstream press and whatnot. Here's an interesting something that I got an email from my father's first attorney when he was just when Watergate happened. An attorney by the name of Douglas Caddy. He emailed me just the other day because of the Coast to Coast show. He had caught some of it, and he said that that he had prior to Watergate, he had represented Billy Sol Estes in some kind of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Sol Estes was Lyndon Baines Johnson's dirty tricks guy, bagman, hitman, whatever you want to call him. He was a dangerous character, and he just emailed me and wanted to let me know that he was proud of what I was doing, and that Billy Sol Estes had in fact told him years before this that he knew that Lyndon Baines Johnson was one of the movers and shakers in the JFK assassination.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted to pass that on to me. So people are coming out in great numbers, supporting what I'm doing, and I think this is almost as close to a smoking gun as you can get.
Whether Lee Harvey Oswald was involved or not, was a shooter or not, you do not believe then in the lone gunman theory, do you?
No, I don't. I just think that's preposterous to believe in that theory. I think that bullet was planted at Parkland Hospital by somebody, and they can spin all the high-tech tests they want, but you've got too many coincidences, too many layer upon layer upon layer of circumstantial evidence. I mean, there's just absolutely no way that Lee Harvey Oswald could have acted alone. And my father certainly did not told me that he did not act alone, that there was, in fact, a second gunman on the grassy knoll. And he named that gunman as a French Corsican underworld gunman imported into this country, brought into the plot by Kordmeier, who had the European connections, to serve as a second shooter. And my father told me that this gentleman's name was either Sartre or Sarti, and as we now see, that there is a individual named Lucien Sarti.
Yeah, he's a Corsican assassin.
He That's
was
right.
A drug trafficker as well.
Yes, sir.
Did your father ever mention at the time George Bush Senior, who
No.
went on to run the CIA and then become a president? He never
No,
mentioned his
he
name.
Never mentioned George Bush Senior to me.
Because there always talk that he was there in the Dealey Plaza area at the time.
Oh, really? I had not heard that before.
And nobody knows if that
yeah.
was true or not. Again, so many other stories keep coming up. But
well, certainly the tramp story has been floated for a number of years, and there's been a lot of energy, trying to disprove trying to prove who the tramps were. They finally, there's at least two people that have come on record as saying, for each of the three tramps, there's at least two people saying that, yeah, that's me. So, it's just one of those things that's not hard for people with the right connections to find people to come out and say, oh, yes, that was me,
If this is true, this story, this remarkable story is true, that means that in 1963 there was a coup in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed it does. Yeah, a well-orchestrated coup, and I think the general public has an idea that in order to carry off something like this, you have to have, there would have to have been too many people involved. There's no way you can run a conspiracy of that magnitude. But really, what it boils down to is having a very few people in the right position to do something like this. You have to have
a man like Lyndon Johnson who will, you know, sit on the throne, and basically Dallas was his home turf. So he could definitely orchestrate and keep an eye on all the goings on in that state, and also on a federal level too.
Nearly 44 years since the assassination. Do you believe there are still many people involved who are still alive?
You know, the only person that I believe may still be alive is Veciana. But what his involvement may or may not have been, I'm not really sure. It's known that he and my father worked together during the Cuba invasion. It's also known that Veciana is a very colorful character. He founded Alpha 66, which is the most violent and militant anti-Castro Cuban exile group, funded by the CIA, trained by the CIA. And it's also well known that an assassination attempt was made in the last 2 years again on Antonio Veciana, and he's also been linked as the contract agent that David Atlee Phillips handled. So David Phillips was Veciana's handler and purportedly met with Oswald in Mexico City in 1963 in the summer.
Ironically, Fidel Castro is still alive.
Isn't that amazing?
Barely, but still alive.
Yes, indeed. That is truly amazing. And I think when he passes away, there's going to be a real storm up there, you know, wherever those guys are going to wind up. But yeah, it's fun to think about that.
Well, it's a wound that still has not healed in this country yet.
Yeah.
I think people still feel it. I think it's affected people in a way that they probably don't realize.
Yeah.
St. John, I want to thank you for being on the program. We'll still stay in touch with you, and I do believe there's going to be a very major story now. And again, whether people will believe, of course, the words from your late father, an operative, you may want to accept it with caution, healthy skepticism as well. Would he hide the involvement of certain individuals to whom he remained loyal, including people who still might be alive? But regardless of what you think, I believe more than ever now that John F. Kennedy was killed by a group of people, that there was a plot, that there was a coup.